What advice would you give to if you were going to start Reebok today? Are there things that you would do a little bit differently, or how would you start today?
Well, I think it's essential that you've got to decide and focus where you're going to be, because you can't do too many things when you're starting. You've got to really be able to focus on where you're going to be and what you're going to be. On managed to do it, and one or two people have managed to do it. Under Armour managed to do it not that long ago. They managed to break in. So, but you've got to specialize, and you've got to have influence. Finding how you're going to influence. And today, it usually costs money.
Hi, I'm Eric Weir, and welcome to another episode of Stuttering Your Way to Success. Please join me with my very special guest, Joe Foster, the founder of Reebok and author of How to Survive and Thrive. We'll talk to him today about Survive and Thrive and about Reebok. But Joe, what was it like growing a company from just a few people to thousands of people with huge sales?
Thank you for the invitation, Eric. It's great to speak to you. It's what can you say now? Growing a company, it took a few years, so it wasn't sort of overnight. Although, you know, after 20 years, we became an overnight success.
Overnight success, right? Yeah.
But those first 20 years, of course, it was I guess leaving the family business. Really, we left the family business, Jeff and myself, because we had to. The family business was dying. It was one of those unfortunate things. My father and uncle, who took over the business when my grandfather died, didn't really move it. They just sat on it. They just sort of went along there and went along there. And by the time Jeff and I got into the business, the biggest problem was that my father and uncle didn't speak to each other. A bit like Addy and Rudy Dassler, and with the Dasslers, Rudy left the company and set up Puma. With the Foster company, my father and uncle, they just kept feuding, and of course, the only one result of that, when it's 50-50 on the business fails, and that's what happened for Jeff and myself. The business was failing, so we needed to consider our future careers. And eventually got round to the point, well, father wasn't listening, and certainly my uncle wasn't listening. So we left the company and we set up our own company. Right, so now we're on our own and we have very little money, because we didn't inherit anything. We just sort of, well, that's it, we're going. The best thing that we had done, though, is we'd gone to college for a couple of years. We went to college at night. We'd gone to college at night to learn more about shoemaking. But the big advantage to that was that when we did leave, we had a lot of friends. A lot of friends who we met at the college, whether they were the instructors or whether they were just other people also learning. And so when we needed things, we just asked a few questions, asked some of these people, and we could get machinery, we could get where do you find materials, and we got all that. So that was okay. However, yes, it was sort of bootstrapping, as I say, because we didn't have any angels in those days. We didn't have any VCs, and the banks, all the banks wanted was collateral. So if we had no collateral, and of course, since we didn't have much money, we couldn't expect the bank to be supporting us. But we were working quite nicely, local. We're all local athletes. And so that was good. And we sort of, I say, struggled in those early days. Well, we probably struggled for quite some time, but it became quite it's a learning curve, really. Because even in those early days, 18 months after being into business, and we started our business as Mercury Sports Footwear. And we were making some money. We were doing all right. Probably as well as working for the family business. We were earning a salary, going home at night, and that was okay. Although I wouldn't say going home at night. That was just sort of going from the workroom in the factory to what was a sort of living quarters. So we were living on the factory in those early days. And eventually we started to feel, we're doing all right. We're earning money and we're building things. But when the accountant said, you'd better register that name. We haven't even heard of the fact that we've got a registered name. I was 23 when we started. Jeff was 25. And we tried to register it, but we couldn't. So our first challenge that had come upon us. And, so what do we do? Well, the name Mercury had already been registered by a British shoe corporation. They were a giant of an organization, and we didn't. No chance. We said, well, what can we do? And they said, well, we'll ask them, because they're not using it, how much do they want? And they wanted £1,000. Well, we just set up our whole factory for £250. So we just didn't have that sort of money. So the answer to that was, bring me a new name. Bring us a new name. And it was a nice day in May when I went to see the agent, and he had his window open, pointed to a sign down the road, Kodak. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kodak. What's Kodak? Well, we knew what Kodak was. What's with Kodak? Well, he said they invented the name. They made it up. So when it's made up, you own it. That's it. Bring me a name. Yeah, bring me a name like that you can make up. But don't bring me one. Bring me 10. And, that was like, how do you do that? How do you bring up 10 names in the hope you're going to get one to call your business?
Right.
Oh, I remember. I went back to the office and we sat down and we're thinking, okay, that's right. Cougar Sports. Cougar. That's a pretty good name. Let's Cougar Sports. Or Falcon Sports. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. We're going down the route, obviously, of birds or animals, right?
Right.
Yeah. But let me take you back now. This is 1960. 18 months into our business, we started in 1958. Take you back now to 1943, and in 1943, we had World War II. So everything at that time, we couldn't go anywhere, just like COVID. But we did have local events, and I won a race. for this race, I got a prize. Oh, yeah, went up, collect my prize. What did I get? Well, I got a dictionary. And I'm saying, well, where's the football? Come on, I'm 8 years old. Where's the football? What can I do with the dictionary? We didn't even have schools because schools had all closed down. It was during the war. They'd all been taken over. All the teachers were on the front line. Anyway, I got my book, my Webster's. It was a Webster's dictionary. And a Webster's dictionary is an American dictionary. So what an American dictionary was doing in the UK in 1943, I have no idea.
Still no right.
But I got an American dictionary. So let's fast forward now to 1960. Okay, we're looking for names. My dictionary sat next to me on the table. I opened it at the letter R. I don't know why, but I like the letter R. So bit of luck. We opened the letter R. And I start thumbing through this. I come across R-E-E-B-O-K, Reebok. What's that? He said, it's a small South African gazelle. We're a running company. Wow, that's got to go top of the list. Put that top of the list. Eventually, we got 10 names. Went back to the agent and said, look, I only want 10 names, but we want this one. We could be in love with Reebok. But you know, the guys are... He's a lawyer, and they said, okay, Joe, see what we can do. And so he had to check all our names through with the registrar. And 2 weeks, it took him 2 weeks to do all this. 2 weeks later, he came back, and he said, Joe, you've got your wish. You can have Reebok. One caveat, the registrar said, if somebody is making shoes out of Reebok skin, you can't stop them. Jeff and I thought, it's never going to happen. That'll never happen. Nobody will ever Yeah, that's never going to happen. We'll have that one.
Low probability. Yeah.
Okay. So the registrar let us have it on a caveat that because somebody may make shoes out of Reebok skin, we'll put you in the B section of the register. Well, we didn't care. Up to a month before that, we didn't even know there was a register. So, okay.
Right.
That'll do for us. However, 10 years later, the registrar came back to us and said, we've moved you now. We've moved you to the A section. Okay, right. Mm. And he said, well, everybody now knows that Reebok is a sports shoe. And unfortunately, the animal will have to come second. So we got to the A section of the register. And that was our first experience of some sort of problem coming along. Our second problem, 4 years into the business, was a letter from Adidas. Yeah, the Adidas lawyers wrote to us to say that our silhouette, which was two stripes and a T-bar, we rather liked it, but our silhouette infringed the three stripes. For a few minutes, we sort of said, oh, no. Now, well, and then we thought, listen, we're getting a letter from Adidas. We're only a small little company. They know we're here. Well, that's good. They know we're here. Okay. What do we do? Well, we've got used to this now. We'll just change our silhouette. So we changed it to the Vector, which is still there today on Reebok shoes. And I guess we learned that challenges are opportunities. And, you know, from those sort of moments, every time we got a challenge, in fact, we were looking for things, you know, what's challenges? How can we turn that around? How can that become an opportunity? And so anytime, if somebody even sort of said bad things about Reebok, we got in touch. We knocked on his door and almost made him part of the company, because if we did what he wanted us to do, then he'd be the best guy to say good things about the company. And
right.
Anybody who's willing to say bad things about your company, you know, the top, they like to him. So we'd like him to turn them around. And they become your best people. They become your best customers, in fact. So that was for us. And we grew and we scaled our company because we met a lot of people. We went out to the athletes. We did what we could to own the athletics market. And we grew to the point where we really had that athletics market sort, plus a couple of other areas. Rugby league. Rugby was a small sport in the north of England. And we managed to get almost every team into Reebok rugby boots. So we were at that size where we were then saying, okay, we're making a bit of money, we're doing all right, but what should we do next? Do we expand our offering of product? And well, what can we go into? Soccer was the obvious one. But soccer was owned by Adidas. They had already come in. In fact, they owned it when Jeff and I left the parent company. Soccer was Adidas. That would cost a lot of money. So what do? If we can't expand our range, can we expand the territory that we're working in? Doing well in this, where can we go? Do we go to Europe, America? Europe is 28 countries, 28 languages and different cultures. That's a tough one. That's the fact. We would be up against Adidas and Puma on their territory, which again was like, that might be dangerous, that might be difficult. We might not be able to afford that. So how about America? Yeah, but America's a long way off. And I got a bit of opposition on the fact that it's going to cost too much to get across to America, let alone what we might be able to do in Europe. However, luckily for us, the British government were advertising in a magazine called Eurosport. We want you to export, in particular to America. So we'll pay for you to have a stand at the NSGA show, National Sporting Goods of America. We'll pay for the stand. We'll pay for your return airfare. And we'll pay 50% of your hotel bill. Well, I got no opposition. You can go. So I went. However, on doing that, I went in 1968. And I didn't get anywhere until 1979. It took me 11 years.
11 years, wow.
To crack the American market, to get in. Let's put it this way. A lot of the people who were also part of that government expertise didn't even get there. They didn't even make it. And even after 11 years. And I look back on that and I think, well, we didn't have computers. We didn't have smart.
What made America so hard? I mean, to go to America, you hear 11 years, 12 years. I mean, why was that so difficult to start in America?
Well, think about it. 11 years, and there was one chance a year to go to America. So I only had 11 opportunities to get across there and see what I could do. It wasn't as though I had opportunities every day, every month, as now you can do with computers. You can contact everybody. You can do a lot of things. We couldn't do that. So in a way, it wasn't too bad. And I say, of all the companies, there must have been about 20 British companies, part of the British contingent in the NSGA. We had a big collective stand. And I don't think anybody else actually made it. In fact, I remember that when we did make it, I went onto the British stand and they said, "Wow, you've done it. Well done. You're lucky. You've got your own stand." So we had our own stand as well. But what made it difficult? Well, I had 6 failed attempts. I had 6 failures. Tried to get in there with people that could have, but we didn't make it.
Sure.
And it was really 1979. It was up to Runner's World. This is the difference. Up until then, I've been pushing, but Runner's World, they grew with running. And that was the other good bit of luck that we had. Running grew fantastically. And as a result, Runner's World grew from a single page to a 70-page full-color magazine that everybody was out there running, training, taking part in 5K, 10Ks, half marathons. They all read it. And when Bob Anderson, who edited that, decided he could tell people which were the best shoes, he tried it twice of saying, well, first one, it was Nike. It didn't work. Second one, I think it was New Balance. The reason it didn't work is that all the product was coming from the Far East. And of all the people that read the magazine, probably anything between 10 and 30 million wanted that number one shoe. Nobody in the Far East could turn up the production to get that sort of quantity. So on the third attempt, Bob Anderson decided he would change it to, which was number one, to 5-star ratings. So it was star ratings. A 5-star shoe, you got a 5-star shoe, and there could be 4 or 5 that would get 5-star shoes if that's what happened. We thought, oh, you know, we're in this business. We should be able to make a 5-star shoe. And so we plowed away. And I remember phoning Paul Fireman because I met him in the February of 79. Running was so big in those days, everybody wanted to get into it, but there was a bit of effort. And Paul said, look, Joe, if you get 5 stars, I'll be a distributor. Paul was running an outdoor business, Boston Camping. And I think he was a bit fed up of what was going on. I think he was going around the Goldfish Bowl every year, and 10 years into the business, that was it. It was just repeat, but not getting anywhere. So he said that. So we get to the end of July, because August was the edition, and I phoned Paul. I got a call through to him and said, Paul, can you go down to the local kiosk and see if they've got the Runner's World August edition, the shoe edition? He came back about a couple of hours later and said, Joe, yes, you got 5 stars, Aztec. Fantastic. None of that, your other offerings, your Spike track shoe and your racing shoe, also got 5 stars. So we entered the market into America with 3 5-star shoes. Now, the difference is we've been pushing for 11 years. We got 5-star ratings. All of a sudden, we got credentials. And that was the difference.
How do you maintain innovation? I mean, when you grow from a small company, when it's just you and your brother, and then you're trying to innovate and compete with giant competitors. So how did you get the edge?
Well, I think how we managed it in the UK was, it's no secret, you know, influencers. You need influencers. And we were well inside the athletics arena. We were well known. We worked in the, and so we used to produce our shoes for athletes, and we had one, Ron Hill. He actually won the Boston Marathon in record time in Reebok. He won that, and we had to think of ideas. We invented Reebok Racing Club, and Reebok Racing Club, you know, we got to the point in the sort of mid to late 70s where every capital city in all the countries around the world were putting on marathons. And they had marathons, they were on television. They were always televised. So we would work with our athletes. One may win, but really most of those athletes would not win. But they could really go well for 20 miles. So we produced Reebok Racing Club, you got a vest with Reebok Racing Club on it. We gave them the vest and the shorts and gave them shoes. And a lot of people, we opened up as a club so they could buy this as well. But we told our top guys, look, when you take part in these marathons, and we help them to get into the marathons, go to the front, stay at the front as long as you can. And that gets us on television. So we were on television at the front of so many marathons with Reebok Racing Club. We'd have four or five on television for probably 20 miles before they faded and went away. But so it's the influencing, and that's how you do it. And Ron Hill, we made him a shoe, and that was called the 10K. So he held the 10. It was called the World 10. It was 10 miles. He held the record for the 10-mile world record. So we call it World. And that was a special shoe. It had no heel because he didn't land on his heel. He only landed on the front of his foot. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was very specialized. But top runners, that's how they run. They don't hit. Sure. They don't heel strike. They actually strike with the ball of the foot. So we were top runners winning races in World 10.
What advice would you give to if you were going to start Reebok today, right? I mean, knowing what you now know, are there things that you would do a little bit differently, or how would you start today?
Well, I think it's essential that you've got to decide and focus where you're going to be, because you can't do too many things when you're starting. You've got to really be able to focus on where you're going to be and what you're going to be. And if you can find something that's slightly different, we can probably use a company like On. They gave us a different vision. They made a different soul. And that gave them. But then, of course, they use Roger Federer as well. So anybody starting today, you've got to look and say, where do you want to be? We could say that the sports footwear arena is pretty full of manufacturers. There's a lot of people in there today. But On managed to do it, and one or two people have managed to do it. Under Armour managed to do it not that long ago. They managed to break in. So, but you've got to specialize, and you've got to have influence. It's finding how you're going to influence. And today, it usually costs money.
How do you find good people? I mean, I've talked to people today. They're like, they're worried about finding the right kind of talent. So what is it that you look for in a person before you hire them?
Well, we were very fortunate. We were actually working in this community of athletes. And athletes, they had their own business, whatever it was, or they worked at something. But good athletes, they wanted to join the company. And these athletes, okay, not that you didn't take everybody on. You needed to have somebody who really could think about something. Like Ron Hill. Ron Hill didn't start to work for us, but he was a university graduate and he was in the textile industry. But he came to us and he wanted to work with us for the shoe, the World 10. Okay, so we didn't employ him, but he was that close to the company that we could have employed him. It was as simple as that. But a lot of athletes who came along, and they were so into it. Because their interest was the same as ours, it was easy. They became part of it.
Right.
And
right.
So developing your business with those sort of people, and they talked about it because they weren't employed by Reebok, but they were part of Reebok. These athletes represented Reebok. And for Reebok in those days, we had two areas. We had a factory which employed people who were making shoes. So they had a skill in making shoes. But when we talk about the other side, which is where we sold our product was sold in the sports goods industry. And so that was different. We set up two companies. The manufacturing was one company, and we called it Reebok International because it was going to look after our business. But even the guys who worked for us, they loved being part of this community that we grew this community. They felt part of that community. And it's in my book, Shoemaker, that we ran into some trouble. We ran into trouble quite often. Our distributor, he went out of business. and that was about 90% of our production was going to this this distributor, you know, which is like, you think, okay, is that a big mistake? All your eggs in one basket. The reason I did it is because it gave me an opportunity to start working on the American market and other markets. But unfortunately, we got our way out of it. But some of the workers that we had to lay them off. And quite a few said, can we work for nothing? We'll just work for you. It's just because they felt part of the problem. And they felt that, we said, no, you can't do that. The minute that we're right again, when things come our way, we'll let you know and you can come back. And they all came back. And we managed to turn a corner in 3 months. We had to collect all the product that was with that distributor. We had to go down and collect it all, bring it back, and then figure a way of selling it. And we sold it to schools. We sold the schools at half the price that we'd normally pay, but we were still getting more money than using our distributor. So we made something out of it. And we created a lot of friends.
That's fantastic. With all that you've learned over the years, and both personally and in business, if you could go back and talk to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
I guess the advice was to enjoy yourself as much as you can do. Have as much fun as you can do. Because as you grow up, you won't have those the same energies. When you get a bit older, you won't have the same energies. So really burn yourself out as much as you can because you'll love it. And
Right.
Get yourself into whatever you're doing. Be 100%. Okay, that might not be very conducive to a family life, but try and bring the family with you.
Okay, that sounds good. I love your book, How to Survive and Thrive, One Golden Nugget. What started this and why did you do this?
Well, having written Shoemaker, and I wrote Shoemaker because after stepping back from Reebok, and we still hadn't got computers, I stepped back and relaxing in Tenerife, and that's very nice. And then after a couple of years, we got computers and we got smartphones and we got Google and we got Wikipedia. And these guys are telling me exactly how Reebok started. It didn't happen that way. And I'm saying, no, that didn't happen. There was even a photograph of Joe Foster, the founder of Reebok, and it wasn't me. So who it was? It might have been Joe Foster, but it certainly wasn't me. I wrote the book. And after writing the book, we're getting calls from different people and universities, colleges, because they said, look, this is a business book. There's a lot of things in here that if you go and start your business, you're going to have to face the same problems. And a lot of ways on which you look at your problems. I think one of the first things is that I started business with my brother. We could have been just like my father and uncle, but we didn't. And Jeff loved making shoes. He just loved the factory. And so it was said, Jeff said, look, I'll look after the factory. You do everything else. So I got to do everything else, which was playtime for me. It was great. Okay, I made a lot of mistakes, but we never had that. We never had a bad meal together, which was great. So the pity is, of course, that unfortunately he passed away just as we got into America. So he never saw the growth, saw the opportunity there. Whether the decisions I made would have been made had Jeff still been around. I doubt it. I doubt that would have changed something. So maybe I was able to do things quicker because I could, it was just me.
Sure.
And also maybe with more determination. We've got this now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. If losing your brother maybe gave you more resolve to push through.
I think it certainly did. It was one of those things that, no, we can't. We've got to take this now and make it. It's got to happen.
And no matter what it takes, there's no plan B. We're moving ahead.
That's right. No plan B. Yes.
That's fantastic. How important is not having a plan B in business?
Well, I think it means that you don't rely on something. You've got yourself. You can't sort of say, okay, we can move over. Plan B would be a big thing. The fact that if you're going in the wrong direction, that you change, do that. Whichever. I mean, we pivoted from being a small running company to become a woman's company that took us to almost $1 billion in 4 years. We were still the same company, even though our audience was much different.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What inspires you today?
What inspires me today? I think I'm as inspired today as ever because I see opportunities now for Reebok. And talking about my journey, I think anybody could do it. As you see from How to Survive and Thrive, I mean, some of those, some of the things that people have come through, you know, I mean, you're in Survive and Thrive. You know what it's like to have to go through that situation where you don't know, but you keep faith. And so... having met such a lot of people through Shoemaker, we start to talk stories, and those stories now we're actually looking for stories, and we're gathering those stories and we're putting them in the book. So that now is exciting. Plus the fact it gives us an opportunity to return something. We're now part of building a school. Is that in Uganda?
Yeah,
I got it right this time. The school in Uganda. We're building a school in Uganda. Which is good. And on the second book now, the charity we're going to is Samaritan Feet, which is in Florida, not in Florida, it's in South Carolina. And they've already put 10 million pairs of shoes on feet of children and adults who can't afford them. So that's a great way of working with charities. So, you know, there are those things which inspire both Julie and myself to just keep going on this one. And it's plus the fact it's fun. And we meet a lot of people similar to ourselves.
I bet. Is faith an important part of your life?
Not really. I think for me, it's you don't know. There is no answer to why are we here. There's no answer to it, so it's got to be okay. And you know, we're not churchgoers; we don't have a faith like that, but we do. We're good human beings. Yeah, we believe in other people.
Sure, of course. When you mentioned faith earlier, you have a faith in yourself, a faith that you're saying the plan B. You realizing when your brother passed that you would focus yourself.
Yeah.
So you have a reliance and a resolve on your own abilities and your ability to
and that's your faith, definitely. Yes, it's you've got the faith in what you're doing and how you treat other humans and what your relationship will be with other humans. I think that's probably true. And it's, you know, it amazes you that some people just treat other people in the way they do. That is surprising, and it's destroying sometimes. It is. You think that after, I mean, okay, I've been around for over 80 years, and I've seen an awful lot of that. And I still wonder why. When, you know, it says, as Winston Churchill said, if only people could learn to live with each other, science would do the rest.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I love Winston Churchill. I mean, he was such an inspiration. His speech about never giving up is one of my favorites. What would you like to be remembered as, or in your mind? I mean, what, you know, if you look back and say, I spent my life this way, how would you like other people to view your contribution?
Well, I would just hope that they would think, you know, there were opportunities there, and we moved along with those opportunities. We made a lot of friends, and we got lucky in the right times. We kept working, we got lucky. And, yeah, it wasn't a bad name. It was it Reebok, you know, came out with it. So for people to say, yeah, he did all right.
That's fantastic. So what else is next for you?
Well, we're already working on Book 2. And this year we will be in America at least 3 times. And right now it's almost fixed that we're going down to Australia in June. So traveling is what's next. Again, we just continue traveling and meeting a lot more people. And hopefully continuing on what we're doing now, which is having a lot of fun.
That is fantastic. I love your advice. You know, work hard. We have energy. Work very hard. Have fun along the way, and take your family with you. So that's fantastic advice. Well, thanks for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you all. This is Eric Weir with Studying Your Way to Success with my very special guest, Mr. Joe Foster. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Eric. Thank you.